Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or a guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have classes today
in both stores.
San Diego at 9 o'clock. It's going to be succulent bonsai with Al Klein. And in Poway at 9:30, it's going to be container gardening with Tammy. We were talking before we came on the air. You know Al Klein very well, mm-hmm. right, John?
Not many people in the business just utterly blow me away. Al Klein totally blows me away with the plants he has. Some of the coolest stuff. And you'll see him at Walter Anderson Nursery at Point Loma Store. I was there this week and they had some crazy cool stuff from Al Klein that's there. So,
and now I have one from last year. You gave me for my birthday. It's on our front porch from Botanical Wonders, right? That's his company.
Yeah, that's right. And so I'm going to that class. I am not going to miss it.
It should be a good one. Yeah, he grew mostly caducifolm stuff, right?
Yeah, he really is into the pachyforms and caducifolm stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is like truly plant nerd, plant geek stuff. This is beyond the pale.
So for people that aren't familiar with the term caducifolm or pachyform, it's a really thick stalk or trunk for the plant. I'm trying to think of something just off the top of my head.
Well, a pachypodium.
Pachypodium.
Is one. Yeah. Dioscorea is a kind of that in that genre. In some ways, like Ficus palmeri.
Yes.
You know, the Baja rock fig. Anyway, he grows all of it. And the coolest stuff you will ever see. I remember visiting at his wholesale nursery, and about every 3 feet, my jaw would drop. So, yeah, I will definitely be there.
Okay. I'm trying to remember where. Maybe it was at Barrels and Branches, but I saw, well, it used to be, I still refer to it as a Cistus jutea.
Oh, yeah.
They had a huge one there. It was the most expensive one I've ever seen. Mm. I think it was $300 or $400, which really surprised me.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a neat plant.
Mm-hmm. Those are very cool.
Really interesting plant.
So we're not too hip for the room. What is that plant?
What is the common name? Something grape.
It is something grape.
And it's poisonous. Don't eat the grapes from that one. Yeah. You know, boy, it's one of those 20,000 binomials I've forgotten, apparently. At least momentarily. Yeah. Three in the morning, I'll wake up and go, of course, there it is.
Yeah, we'll get it to you when we remember it.
It's a neat plant.
Okay. It's cool.
Fleshy foliage, goes dormant in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. You know, another really interesting caducifolm plant that I know there's a stand of it right now. We've mentioned it on the show before. And of course, I can't remember. It's a California native. Goes completely dormant in dry season and looks like it's dead. And then as soon as it gets,
Aesculus californica?
Is it the Coreopsis?
You're thinking Coreopsis gigantea.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
That's cool. With a very thick trunk.
Really thick trunk, really fleshy fern-like foliage, and just a profuse bloomer of yellow flowers when it rains. And there's a big stand of it up on Spring Canyon.
Yeah, we have talked about this, yes.
On Spring Canyon Road in Scripps Ranch.
Cyphostemma jutea. That's it.
Easy for you to say.
Yes. Yeah.
So what is that common name of that one? Gosh. See?
That's the one with the grapes you were mentioning?
Wild grape is the common name. And it's Cyphostemma jutea. I have a picture of one that I rescued from a house that was being torn down in Encinitas. And this had to be 80 years old, and it was
Oh, my word.
I've posted a photo of it on Facebook on the garden website, and it was one of the biggest ones I'd ever seen. And you have to be so careful. This is just a word to the wise. A lot of these plants like that, these succulents, Cyphostemma particularly, Pactopodiums are another one, we would wrap those literally in padding and carpet, because if you even bump those when you're transplanting or moving them and things like that, it will rot. So it'll actually make a terrible bruise. So a lot of the things like aloes, they just really do not do well if you are rough with them.
Yeah.
You want to treat them very gently when you transplant.
Pachypodiums, you definitely want to wrap them, because
well they're spiny too. Yeah. But even if you break the spines on those, you can actually lose the plant.
Really?
Yeah, they are very tricky. Very tricky plants.
There was another. I am not, my memory is gone today. Desert rose, but
Adeniums.
Yeah, that's another example of a caudiciform plant. And those have gotten very popular over the past few years.
They've hybridized a lot of new colors.
Yeah, yeah, it used to be the only color you could get was red, mm-hmm. and now there's a whole slew of colors out there.
Yeah,
that you can choose from. Another interesting plant. There's a YouTube channel that I follow called Sidetrack Adventures. And the guy who hosts it, that's all I've ever heard is him called. He's based here in San Diego. Hmm. And he goes out through Southern California and does stories about little known things and just bits of history. It's really interesting. Oh. He's got some really neat stuff. But he was up in Johnson Valley where they went to they call it the King Clone creosote bush, which I'm familiar with creosote bush. It grows all over the desert. But I had no idea that it was so slow growing. And the one that they specifically went to was a stand of it. And it typically doesn't grow. It grows as a single plant, but as it grows, it spreads out into a kind of a circular form. But
the
it's
centers,
all
the centers start to die
the
center, off.
The centers right. die right. off, and then it moves outward in mm-hmm. kind of roughly circular pattern. The one that they found, or the one that they specifically went to see, it's in a protected area in Johnson Valley. There's no off-roading vehicles or anything like that, but you can hike through it. It's 11,700 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was just blown away that it was that old.
Wow.
And Richard Attenborough actually did a piece about it. He did it twice, 40 years apart.
1982 and 2022.
Yeah. Yep. And they took screenshots from his documentaries and compared them. And you couldn't tell that it had grown at all.
Oh my goodness.
In 40 years.
I've had plants like that. People ask me all the time when I'm giving advice or designing a garden, and they'll say, so what's the rate of growth on this? And I said, well, there's some choices. There could be fast, medium, slow, or what I call glacial.
Yeah.
This is less than glacial.
This is less than glacial. Yeah.
This particular plant, as Ken was alluding to, the 40 year delta. Mm. It grew less than an inch in 40 years, less than an inch.
Yeah. But they did DNA testing, and that's how they determined that it is, even though it looks like individual plants kind of grow that have for some reason been planted in a circle, it is actually one plant.
One organism.
It's so not a clone.
What's fascinating is after I watched it, I went to Google Earth and I just went to the Lucerne Valley there and started looking in Johnson Valley, depends on which part you tag it as, and looked, and you can see a lot of the creosotes in that growing pattern with the circles. And then you can really zoom in and see the larger ones like this.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. Very, very, very interesting. But yeah, so if you're sitting around in the evening and there's nothing good on television, check out Sidetrack Adventures.
I'm going to look that up. Well, you know, when you think about it too, what is the, one of the main uses of creosote is to make wood not rot.
Yes.
So clearly, an 11,000 year old organism. It's not rotting.
It's been around for a while.
I will I will put that on our Facebook page, a link to that video.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Another really interesting channel that's on there. Actually, I end up watching more stuff on YouTube than I do on regular television because it doesn't matter what your interest is. If you search on YouTube for it, there's somebody catering to you. Somebody's catering to it.
They'll teach you to do your plumbing. That's what I did. I had to replace a cartridge on a shower and I couldn't figure out how to get this thing out. And I look it up and here's, hi, I'm Billy Bob Plumbing in Arkansas. And he showed me how to do it. And YouTube is great, Ken.
I completely agree. I was working on a project a few weeks ago. I was rebuilding a carburetor for one of my cars, and I had taken it all apart.
Ken?
it took me far. I hadn't done it in a long, long time. It took me far too long to get back into it. And after I took it apart, I was trying to get the choke mechanism hooked up, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I finally got really frustrated, and I went in the house, grabbed my iPad, and searched it. And sure enough, it came right up. So
cool.
Got to put back
another guy from Arkansas, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing what you can find there. But anyway, this other channel that I happened to come across is called Medieval Times Discovered. And one of the things that was in that, one of the episodes that I watched, we'll put the link up for this one too, was 15 medieval vegetables that are not around today. And it was really interesting. There was some stuff that I had never heard of before. Most of it I had never heard of before. The only one that I was really familiar with was the last one that they did, and that was turnips.
Right.
Which I didn't realize that they traced back that far. But George, we were talking about it before we came on the air. As far as turnips are concerned, you can grow them not just for the root, but also for the greens.
Correct. Yeah. And I remember growing some seeds that I purchased here that were really just the turnip greens. They didn't really form the bulb, kind of like getting Swiss chard and beets. Same plant, you just don't form the bulb.
Hmm. Yeah. It was it's really interesting, some of the stuff that they used to grow.
You know, they had lovage on there too, which I found interesting.
That was one that I should know. The rest of them,
not so much. Capri and I watched it and she said to me, some of those look really gross. They don't look very appetizing.
Yeah, they
did. Scarrot was the really scarrot. Interesting. Yeah. One.
You know what? Let's talk about that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And we were talking about medieval vegetables that you don't find around very much anymore. And John, you had mentioned just as we were going into the break, skirret, which I had never heard of before.
I hadn't either.
But it looks interesting. It's a root crop, and it
looks like deformed carrots that never got their coloring.
Like clumping. Oh, yeah. It forms a clump of roots. Look like they from the photograph or
almost
from the
like
video.
Agapanthus roots or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's fine. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say the roots. Peruvian lilies,
like a monocot or something. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that I thought that was, and I guess it produces like crazy.
And they're supposed to be sweet, nutty, delicious. Could be one person's opinion. And it says it tastes like a cross between a carrot and a potato.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to know where to find it.
Annapolis seeds.
Really?
I looked it up. Yeah. Because I think I'm going to have to try this.
You're going to try it?
Yeah. Good idea.
Well, good luck getting the dirt off of it.
Soak them.
Yeah. You soak them, you boil them. Yeah.
So
a little dirt never hurt anybody.
But the leaves, the flowers, and the seeds are all edible.
Wow.
Yeah. An interesting plant.
You know, it's almost like a superfood in that regard. I mean, everything is edible on it, so there's not a lot of waste.
Well, I was really surprised watching this segment, how nutritional
a lot of
all these things were. Yeah. I mean, they had a lot of protein, they had a lot of vitamins. it was, I was surprised.
And
I,
and a number of them were cold hardy as well. And they were harvesting in
very
cold hardy. Dead of winter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It was very interesting stuff.
I think in part the reason they fell out of favor is probably not because of nutritional value. It's looks. You know, if you can start growing other things that look pretty. I mean, you know, people, if you go to a grocery store, they're not going to buy an apple that looks a little deformed, but you would eat it off your tree in a heartbeat that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's quite, you know, the case with this.
I think you're probably right, because I, you know, when you look at the produce that's in a, in Vaughn's.
Versus what you're getting out of that I brought, like, you brought Melanie today.
Or to even North Park Produce. The produce at North Park Produce is a fraction of the cost of what it is in Vaughn's. Mm-hmm. It may not be as pretty as what you see in Vaughn's, but it's perfectly fine.
Oh, yes.
I think you're right. I think it's something that it's not an overly attractive plant.
It doesn't look palatable.
It's like I like to think of myself cosmetically challenged,
but deep down inside.
But inside, yes, I'm worthy. Yes. I'm worthy and wonderful, but I'm just maybe not as good looking.
One of the other plants that they mentioned was something that I had never heard of. It's called a strange name, Alexander's.
Yeah.
And I think that was mostly a foliage plant grown for the greens.
Correct. Yeah. And a lot of these, the ones I remember were in the same family as carrots and celery. Mm-hmm. You know, they had the same umbrella seeds forming on the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are exactly similar in terms of family. In fact, one of the things that I learned, I think I learned it from Trish Watlington, if I recall, but years ago I had chickens. And so we were raising homegrown carrots, by the way. Raise homegrown carrots and harvest them just before cooking. What a different experience. But I had all these carrot tops and I said, well, nothing goes to waste. I'm going to feed these carrot tops to the chickens. And she just said, what are you doing? Don't ever do that. Make that into carrot top pesto. Oh, who knew?
My mother.
So delicious.
Yeah, she would cook with carrot tops. And when we made stew, she would use the carrot tops and stew. Yeah. You can overpower a stew with it, but you certainly use them in a lot of dishes.
Well, the carrot top greens made into pesto was exquisite. It was so delicious.
Noted. Oh, yep. Yeah. I'll have to.
Yeah, don't throw those away.
Have to try.
Don't throw any, very few things you have to throw away.
True.
From a garden.
Yeah. Another one that they talked about was, and again, another one I had never heard of before, Good King Henry.
Yeah.
It was an interesting name, but it was basically a 3-in-1 plant. You could eat the foliage, you could eat the stems. And I think that you could use the seed you could grind and use as a spice.
So, I think they use it as a pepper.
It was a pepper substitute. Yeah. Which actually, you know, it would make sense because pepper wasn't introduced to Europe until much later because East Asian.
I think it's East America.
Well, you know what? I'm going to have to look, John. Yeah, I always thought it was.
Well, certain kinds of pepper, like pink peppercorns are from pepper trees in South America, but.
Yeah. Which is the same one we have here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you need pink, if you have a hankering for some pink peppercorns, just find a pepper tree here in Southern California. They're all over the place and they produce them like.
Chinus terebinthifolius.
Yes. Yeah. Then there was another one that I had vaguely heard of, but I wasn't familiar with salsify.
Right. Right. I've heard of that too.
It was a root vegetable and it tastes like seafood.
Like oyster in particular. Oyster, right. And they said during Holy Season, Lent, people were staying away from meats and shellfish or fish, they would eat this plant.
And the monasteries would grow it for that. Wow. Would always have beds of it for that reason. It was a fish substitute.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. This reminds me of Reese's peanut butter cups. Remember the commercial? I'd say two great tastes that go great together, dirt and seafood.
that was an interesting one. Another interesting one that they had mentioned was medlar, which is a fruit. Mm. But they said it's it, it kind of it all it almost looks like a The closest thing I could think of was a pomegranate.
I thought more like a chestnut a little bit.
Could be. Yeah, maybe.
And some of our local gardeners around here grow those in some of the rare fruit growers. Mm-hmm. I think Jacques.
Medlars?
I think Jacques mm-hmm. grows a medlar.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's interesting. They said that when the fruit is ripe, it's inedible. It is so pungent and so sour and hard that it is inedible. So what they would do is they would process it with a process called bledding, which I had never heard of before.
Well, it sounds appetizing.
B-L-E-T. And basically they would just let it, basically just rot.
You let it ferment.
Yeah. And rot for several weeks until it gets soft. And then once it gets to that stage, they said it tastes kind of like cinnamon applesauce.
Yum.
And medieval cookbooks had
lots of recipes for
to make stuff with it.
But bledding is common with, it's in quince and also in persimmon, some of your astringent persimmons. You let them bled so that they become tasty.
I had never heard that term before. Yep. So that's interesting. The quince one makes sense to me.
Well, with regard to the medlar is when they were showing in this documentary, you know, they turn it inside out. It looked like almost like the flesh of a fig or something that was really, but the way they described it, it's like, I don't know who's the first person that's, oh, it's rotten enough for me to eat.
Yeah.
Today,
oh, you know? So that was, oh, goodness.
Yeah.
But it's one of those fruits that is one of the latest in the season to be ready to harvest. So it's late in the season, you know, into winter. And by the time you let it bled and become usable, you're well into the winter. So you have something to eat.
You have something.
I think that's an actress and singer comedian, isn't it? Bled Midlar?
We'll be here all week.
Another one that was, the next one that was on the list was chickweed. It's not the chickweed that we have here that you're trying to kill out of your lawn. Mm-hmm. It was a different variety. I don't know the botanical name on it, but they said it grew everywhere and it would be almost impossible to eradicate it. But the foliage was extremely high in vitamin C.
Hmm.
And because it could harvest it all year round, it gave people a source of vitamin C. Well, although they had no idea what vitamin C was. Yeah. But it was one of those, it was another one of those ones that was incredibly nutritious for what you were getting out of it. So.
A number of these I think most of them were perennials and they self-sowed pretty easily. And I think in many gardens, they described them as, you know, more of a pest, a weed pest, you know, just, they just self-sow and you have them everywhere. And you can find them on roadsides in the UK and in throughout Europe. They're just there. And we would now, if they were in your garden, you would be spraying Roundup or something to get rid of them because they're in your
have
way.
The gardener pull them.
Right. Yeah. You need to pull these weeds. And, you know, if we could go back 500 years, they would be harvesting them out of our garden versus spraying them out.
Another one was, if I can pronounce it, scorzonera, which is a root vegetable. It's, I think they said it was closely related to salsify, but it just kind of looks like a narrow black carrot, but it has white, once you peel it, it has white flesh. Tastes kind of like sweet, kind of an asparagus flavor to it. They said it kept really well. You could pack it in sand, pack the roots in sand in a cool basement, and it would keep for months. So you could get a crop of it and it could sustain you through the winter. And that was another thing that a lot of these things, because they had such long shelf lives, it kept people alive through the winter when there really wasn't much around. And then spring would come and then they could start harvesting other stuff again, eating other things. Another one that was interesting, which I had never heard of before, was Welsh onions. And they're not from Wales and it's not a true onion. It looks like it's in the Allium family. But they said it was very cold hardy and would survive. The greens would grow except in just the absolute coldest winter, so they could harvest the greens all year round, or you could pull the bulb and eat and cook with that and eat that as well. and they multiplied like crazy. Mm. And they would get these huge patches of them. So that was another one that they used, where they were able to harvest during the wintertime to keep them going. Although I don't think I'd want to live on just on onions for, for a while.
Onions are one of those plants, though, that really do self-sow incredibly easily. Mm-hmm. And we have in our current garden right now, much like the lettuce I brought in today, we have onions everywhere because you let a couple plants go to seed and they just drop and they just grow.
I wonder if one of the reasons these plants fell out of favor, when you think back to medieval times or even back to the Revolutionary War, that we were in an ice age and a mini ice age. Yeah. And, you know, when in New York, the rivers are freezing, the Hudson River is freezing and they're marching across to the other side, or the Delaware River freezing. It was a little colder 250 years ago.
A little chilly. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements, and we're talking about medieval vegetables that you just don't find around anymore. We'd finished up talking about Welsh onions. We'd said they're neither from Wales or actually true onions. They actually they were introduced from East Asia, was their point of origin. Another wild green that people ate a lot of was fat hen, which I had never heard of before. Just an interesting green that helped sustain people through most of the year. Another one that I have heard of, and we've actually had it in stock, is lovage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Very easy to grow, very popular plant. You usually find it in the herb section here when we have it available. Another interesting one that was kind of misnamed was corn salad, which it's not corn, and it used to be grown. It got the name from the grain crops that were grown in Europe prior to the introduction of maize from the New World, which is what we know today as corn. But it was a green that would grow in amongst the grain crop. So another one that I'm pretty sure we've had in the past, the name rings a bell, is tansy.
Yes.
Which I believe is when we have it available, I think we sell it as an herb.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Another interesting green was sea kale, which would grow on the shore near the shorelines. So it would tolerate the alkaline, the salty soil, but prodigious producer of greens for their diet.
It's very related. I mean, not very, it is related to cabbage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one that I had never heard of before was woad. W-O-A-D.
Woad is me.
Woad. And it was prized because you could make a blue dye out of the foliage once it was processed, but you could also eat it before you could eat the greens, very healthy source of greens. They said the processing of it to make the blue dye, which they said was about the only way that you could get the pigment to make something blue, was with woad. The process to get the dye meant you had to ferment it, and it was such a horrible smelling operation. It was actually banned in certain areas because it smelled so bad. So.
And that's where the Smurfs came from. They were the ones that would process that.
Yeah, your HOA said there can be no processing. But it said that prior to that, like what you were saying, they didn't have any source for blue. Mm. So you started seeing more blue clothing and materials after that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember where I saw it, but it wasn't YouTube. It was another documentary where they were talking about purple, royal purple, the dye that's made from snails.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually fermented snails, mm-hmm. and the smell.
Oh, goodness.
I don't even want to know.
And they showed the process of making it, and you have to get it to the proper pH, and the way that they would, and granted, this is before they had pH test kits, the way that they would determine that the pH was proper was they would taste it.
Oh,
and if their teeth rotted away, it was acidic enough.
It was horrendous. It was absolutely horrendous.
Who ferments snails and says we should taste this put our clothing in it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. People did some sketchy stuff back then. That's for sure. And then the last one, which we had already mentioned before, was turnips, which you still find them today.
I like turnips.
I do too.
Mm-hmm. And I like turnip greens.
I love turnips.
I like turnips better than beets. Mm. They don't have the dirt flavor that beets do.
Mm. Fair enough.
Yeah. So those were the 15 medieval vegetables that you just don't hear much about anymore. And if you'd like to watch the show for yourself, and I highly recommend it, it's quite interesting. Medieval Times Discovered on YouTube.
I will post a link to that after the show today.
Yeah. So they have some interesting stuff on there. I don't know how I started thinking.
Something I heard this week too. I heard Secretary Kennedy talking about removing artificial food colorings from our diet, which is probably a good idea.
Probably not a bad idea.
But one of the sources of food coloring that they're now going to be looking toward for red just like they used to from the Opuntia cactus. Yep, have cochineal scale.
Cochineal scale.
You talk about red. That is a red.
That is red. Extremely red. Yeah. Anytime you see it's common even in San Diego. You see it a lot on Opuntias. But if you see it and you smash them, it looks like you cut your finger. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly red.
I was going to say it's an ingredient called carmine.
I was going to say
carmine.
Yeah, I was going to say if you look at stuff and it has carmine in it, that's red bug juice more than likely. very common in grapefruit juice.
Not from my yard when I make mine.
they'll use it in pink grapefruit juice to enhance the redness of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you see carmine, you know where it came from. Another interesting crop that I really hadn't thought that much about were potatoes, and they're not native to Europe. It's a New World plant that was brought from Peru by the conquistadors, and it was introduced into Europe in 1536. And then Sir Walter Raleigh introduced potatoes to Ireland in 1589. But they said it took another 40 years after that before they actually spread through Europe, which I thought was kind of interesting.
And then they had their famine.
And then they had their famine, and all the Irish people came over here to escape that. And that was a virus, I think. Was it a fungal issue? Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I know it was
potato
blight. It was bad. Another interesting thing that I had never heard of before was I think it's emmer wheat, and it's a very old form of wheat that would grow just about anywhere. So it was easy to cultivate and grew like crazy. It's a farro. Modern day farro, which I happen to not dislike very much. It's actually a pretty good one.
So. Ken, there seem to be a lot of things you don't like to eat.
there's not that many, actually.
Yeah, if we looked at his wife, she'd be shaking her head in agreement with you, John.
I saw it, and I can't remember where I saw it. One thing that I actually loved as a kid was rhubarb. My grandmother had a big stand of rhubarb in her backyard, and she would fix it in a bunch of different ways. But the main way that she would do it is she would chop it up and boil it down and make it into almost this really thick syrupy soup. And I used to eat that when I was a kid. I used to eat that like crazy. It was one of my favorite things. But I was watching something and they said that during World War II, rhubarb was a staple in Great Britain because it would grow under candlelight.
And
the burning candles also provided the carbon dioxide for them to process. So they would grow it in enclosed spaces lit by candlelight. They said that it really, really helped Britain survive the Battle of Britain during World War II. It was a huge staple for the British people at that time.
But not the leaves.
No.
Yeah, don't eat the leaves. Poisonous.
No, that's
was
not
your
do you
grandmother's
any good.
Stand of rhubarb here in San Diego?
Yeah,
that's what I was going to ask.
No kidding.
It was in their backyard at in Bay Park.
In Bay Park?
Yeah.
Wow. Because most people
it's
I
not
know
easy
that,
to grow here.
That's
no,
what I was going to say. Most people are not successful with that.
Yeah, I've tried growing it a couple of times at my house, and the soil's not. You need really well drained soil.
Right.
And it grows from a big root division.
We had them in my house growing up. It was just like this perennial thing that every winter died off a little and came right back and bigger and better each year. Yeah. You know, we have Farmer Roy next week.
Yes.
And we can ask him about growing rhubarb.
We will.
See if he grows it
here. If he's lucky with it. Yep. And in Alaska, they grow huge rhubarb plants too.
Really?
I've seen, because I used to fish a lot in Alaska, and they're monstrous size up there.
That's interesting.
And it likes the cold weather, apparently.
Yeah, it's a pretty plant.
It is.
They are very,
just
it is.
From a from a foliage standpoint.
Absolutely.
And when the stems are ripe, it's the bright red stems. And that is what you eat on rhubarb is the stems. You don't eat the foliage, which I still don't understand how you can have toxic foliage, but the stem is okay.
Mm. Well, there are a number of plants like that. You can eat certain parts of it. You know, the carissa, the natal plum. The plum itself is safe to eat, and they make jellies and such with it.
It's safe to eat, not good to eat.
But, yeah, well, that's a matter of opinion. Yes, there is a cultivar called Fancy that is a little bit better. But the plant itself, you know, that sap is poisonous or toxic. So there are a number of plants.
That was it. It's interesting that you bring that up, because in a previous show we had talked about plants that are in the Apocynaceae family.
Right.
And that's right. One of them. Mm-hmm. I think plumerias are in that family. Yeah. There's actually a lot of stuff. Star jasmine, I'm pretty sure, is in there.
It is.
Yeah, it is. I think vinca major, minor,
I think oleander
there.
Might eat.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's another one you don't want to
eat that one.
You don't want to eat that one. That's not going to do you any good.
Pause. Back to rhubarb, though. Strawberry rhubarb pie.
Ooh.
Oh, there you go.
When I was a kid, that was the biggest use for the rhubarb.
That's a good use.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to look and see if I still have that recipe.
And then that
my
morphs to strawberry rhubarb pie or cobbler with ice cream on top.
Of course.
Mm.
You know, another thing that my grandparents grew, and you see them every once in a while now, but it's not super common, and I loved it as a kid, was chayote squash.
Yeah.
Super easy. Grows rampant. You put one in the ground and man, it takes off. It used to cover their entire back fence at their house. And my grandmother would harvest them, and she would just slice them in half and take the core out of them and bake them. Hmm. And that was really good.
Ken, you're a boat guy. So I used to sail the Newport 10 Sonata races all the time. And up at the Newport Yacht Club, one of the dishes I love up there is they have chayote squash kind of made into a cold salad, and they have very thinly sliced roast beef with it. And it sounds bizarre, but it's so delicious.
I will have to use my reciprocal privileges.
There you
privileges
go.
And go up there and try that.
Yeah, the food at Balboa Yacht Club is amazing.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back with more right after this.
My brain.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clemens.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. And we are into May. So your garden, if you're planting vegetables, it should be starting to get underway. And you know, we were talking during the break about my grandparents growing so much stuff. They always had something growing in their yard to eat. I mean, my grandfather had an incredible yard just from a landscaping standpoint, but the back portion of the yard, the whole area was set aside just for edibles. And they planted vegetables and fruit trees and grapes and all kinds of stuff. And they were constantly harvesting something. I remember I found some pictures that my grandfather took of my sister and I when we were, I think I might have been 10. So my sister would have been about 5, of some cabbage that my grandfather grew, that the heads on the cabbage, it was the size of a basketball. Mm. They were monstrous cabbage. But they grew all kinds of stuff. Now they both were from farm families in Nebraska. So whatever they could, whatever my grandparents would grow that they couldn't eat right away, my grandmother canned it. And she always had either canned or frozen, always had frozen peaches. They had a Babcock peach in their backyard.
Oh, that's a good variety.
That tree produced so many peaches that my grandfather had to prop the branches up, because he either didn't have the time or just didn't believe in thinning. So it produced stuff like crazy. And if he didn't prop the branches up, it would have torn itself apart. They had an almond tree. So we had almonds, green gage plum. Mm. And they had a big stand of young berries. And
ooh, those are good too.
Grandmother would just, when they were starting to ripen, she would just go out and she would just pick young berries all every day. And she'd bring them in. She'd serve some usually for dessert with dinner. And the rest of it, she just canned them up and froze them. Mm-hmm. So they had stuff all the time. They had stuff year round.
I think that was part of our culture, you know, pre-World War II and into that. My grandfather was very similar in New York, with a pretty big garden and saved seeds, everything. And my grandmother would can or bottle or freeze or ferment, so that there would be food throughout the winter months.
Yeah, I remember as a kid growing up, it didn't matter what time of year it was. My grandparents always had something fresh out of the garden to eat.
Well, you're in San Diego.
Yeah.
We didn't have that luxury as far as fresh.
Well, they didn't, right. And they didn't back right. in Nebraska either.
Right. You know, but here, we're
really harsh.
We do have that ability here to grow things all year.
So, you know, thinking about this video that we saw with these medieval veggies and things, in some ways, we're describing even in, you know, reliquary that's passed. That's not that long ago, Ken.
No, it wasn't.
That your grandparents were raising, like, Babcock peach. What a fantastic peach.
I love it.
Oh, it's one of the best.
Yeah.
And then young berries. You can't find young berries anymore.
No, you don't really see them.
Somebody in the gardener group, San Diego Gardener this week, asked, how do you grow raspberries here? And I said, don't bother. They don't do well. Raspberries don't do well, but plant olale berries, plant triple crown blackberry, young berry, if you could find it, boysenberries. They thrive and will produce so much fruit. And there's a variety called Kiowa.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, that does well.
That's a great one. It's I call it fish hooks on a vine. it's mean and nasty, but it will have blackberries on it at Christmas time.
Yeah. If you don't like the thorns, Monrovia grows a black satin.
Yeah, that's true.
Or black satin blackberry.
Which can revert after time. You've got to be cautious and keep pruning it. But yes, that is another good one.
But the berry vines are ones that you have to be careful of, because they produce on the second, in the second year. So you don't want to go and cut all of this year's growth back, because that's what you're going to get the fruit on the following year. So you kind of need to keep track of what's growing when.
Yeah.
Otherwise you're going to end up with nothing.
Do you recall what the variety of rhubarb was that your grandmother grew?
No,
Victoria is the one that we saw the most, but I'm not familiar with any others.
I don't remember what the cultivar was. Another one that they grew that was a fantastic variety was Himrod grape.
Oh yeah. Excellent.
Produces like
great on the coast.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And and it's seedless.
Mm-hmm.
And when it would, when they were ripe, they had tons of grapes. Mm-hmm. There was always fresh grapes available.
Water must have been a lot less expensive back then.
I think it was. Yeah, I think it was. But they had a huge, huge vine of Himrod grapes on one of the fences in the backyard. But yeah, always something coming out of the garden.
As a kid, going to a place like that, you know, for the fruit portion of it, not necessarily the vegetables, but for the fruit, that's heaven. You mm-hmm. walk out and there are fresh grapes and peaches and apples. And I remember being a child and going to grandpa's house and getting all this grapes and everything. Just walk outside and eat.
Mm-hmm. No,
so your heart's content.
When they were in season, I remember going out and just, you know, playing in the backyard and get hungry, go over and pick a bunch of young berries and have some young berries. Or you'd eat green gauge plums until we got sick.
Wow.
They were so good. And that's a plum that has kind of fallen out of favor, and it's not easy to get anymore.
We put one in last year, so I'm anxious for that.
That's a great variety.
It's really incredibly sweet when it's ripe, but the skin is tart, so it has a really good juxtaposition of flavor.
I like that though. That like spicy nectar plum, the same idea. You take a bite of that skin, and it's a little bitter, and you get that astringency, but then the flesh is so sweet, and that combination is
like
a
kumquat
thing.
Except in reverse.
Right. Yes, a reverse kumquat.
The green gauge plum, it's almost like a mouthful of sugar when they're ripe. It is incredibly sweet. Really, 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 really good plum tree. But yeah, the Babcock peach, that's an outstanding peach. Mm-hmm. It's a white peach.
It is.
Yeah.
So. And it's very, very soft. So you'll never find it available commercially, because in order to get it tree ripened, it is just so soft that, in fact, if you ever find Babcock, they'll usually clamshell those individually and very soft, because they just bruise and they just turn to liquid, basically.
They get all those brown spots and look a little mushy.
And they don't look so good. But we used to take it and puree it, and I'd make peach nectar out of that, which, is that good? We'd make peach sorbet, make peach ice cream, because we would have literally hundreds of fruit.
Oh yeah, the amount that it produced was absolutely amazing. The other thing I remember as a kid too, my grandfather had a Valencia orange, and it seemed like that tree always had oranges on it. And if I was out in the yard with him, he would pick one, pull out his pocket knife, and peel it, because it was really hard to peel.
Mm-hmm.
And peel it with his pocket knife and then give it to me. And I remember that orange was so sweet. And my grandmother would pick them in season, and she would squeeze them for orange juice. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my jobs in her kitchen when I was over, was squeezing orange juice with one of the old glass juicers. And I would just sit there for like an hour or two juicing oranges.
Like your grandfather, I always have a pocket knife in my pocket, and I do the same thing when I'm out there. You know, I eat something off the tree, I'll cut the harvest, the lettuce or whatever. I always have a pocket knife in the garden or on me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I actually planted some of the lettuce seed that we had talked about from that other episode.
That was deer tongue, right?
Deer tongue and the tennis ball.
Right. Tennis ball.
Tennis ball. So that's... I'm assuming that's what was starting to sprout in my containers. It's either that or some weeds. I'll have to wait for a little while to see what it actually turns into. But you should be doing some stuff in your yard and garden this time of the year. I know, John, you're a big fan of fish emulsion.
Yes. Well, you know, things are waking up now. It's warmer, and you'll really see, especially the tropicals and things, your plumeria are beginning to wake up. Palm trees are starting to throw growth. And your citrus, if you missed that all important feeding just before the big flush of blooms and so on, now you probably have fruit set. I'm a big proponent of applying foliarly fish emulsion and liquid chelated iron and zinc using a siphon jet. And if your citrus aren't looking great, that is a way to restore them and really turn them around and make them green and lush again and get them growing a lot better.
Yeah. This is the time of the year that, citrus leaf miner is going to start getting active. So keep a very close eye out for that. Might not hurt to do a preventative spray of spinosad this time of the year.
I was thinking of that. I was looking at ours yesterday, the day prior, and we don't have any yet.
No, not yet. No. It's a little early.
It is, but all the new flesh, the flesh is great.
As it
right
warms
now.
Up. Yeah. I walk by some of mine on an almost daily basis in the yard, and I keep a very close eye on it.
Experientially, what I've found too is that the citrus leaf miner don't go after the very young, tender, succulent leaves. It's when they just begin to harden off. And then as soon as they begin to harden off, that's when you'll start to see the citrus leaf miner. So in my opinion, it's a little early yet, but see, be on the lookout.
It's going to be, we're coming up on that time. And if they do take hold before you get them, before you have a chance to do something to control them, before it gets completely out of hand, you can just pick the foliage off and throw it away and get rid of it. And then make sure that you spray afterwards. And it is amazing. If you get the damaged foliage and you spray the spinosad on them and you feed the plant, the new foliage that comes out perfect. Mm. And the old foliage is still on there, but it'll come out perfect.
Yeah. You just have to be cautious rather, because as John, you just said, you've got all those flowers that are on there, and spinosad is moderately toxic to bees when it's wet. So you want to do it at night or shortly after the flowers set fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. You definitely, any kind of spray, any kind of insecticide you need to be aware of as far as bees are concerned, and try to do it early in the morning or late in the evenings. Evenings is usually the best.
I was going to say, we spoke of this before. The bees at my house are up at 5:30, so you have to get up really early if you want to spray before they're active. So nighttime is the best time for them.
Yeah. So just some of the things that you should be looking out for and watching out for in your garden this time of the year. Classes today in San Diego, it's going to be Succulent Bonsai with Al Klein at 9 o'clock, and in Poway, it's going to be Container Gardening with Tammy at 9:30. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. Next week, we will have Roy Wilburn, Farmer Roy, talking about what you should be doing in your garden this time of the year. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.